This is the second day of this January 2015 Rohatsu 7-day Sesshin. And yesterday we were reading from a collection of talks by the 14th century Japanese Zen master Basui. The book is called Mud and Water, translated by Arthur Braverman. And we read his fairly short material on his biography. And before we get into his own talks, just a couple of points that the translator makes in the introduction after the biography. He says that Basui was very critical of a certain type of monk who was not so uncommon in Basui's day. This is a monk who would disregard the correct behavior befitting a monk and act in an eccentric manner, thinking he was behaving in accord with the spirit of the ancient masters. He might get drunk, act rudely, break the precepts, and think that his unconventional behavior was proof of his freedom from the shackles created by formal practice. And he says that many of these monks may have developed some of these ideas from reading the stories of the ancient masters whose behavior was unconventional, but was for the purpose of teaching others too attached to the conventions of the time. We have some of the same problem, not here in Rochester, but in contemporary Zen generally, both in Japan and in the West, the Americas and Europe, some of the same problem is happening. I can't speak for China. I've not gotten the impression ever that they had the same vulnerability, that the precepts have always been held in higher esteem in China than in Japan. But there are there's plenty of this that goes on. It's not so much the average Zen practitioner as some of the teachers who drink and have sex with their students and all, and although they, I think, usually don't explicitly offer this as a defense, I think often it is this notion that once you've come to awakening, then you can do anything you want, and look at those poor saps who are still following the precepts. It's very sad to see this kind of thing, because so many Zen practitioners don't have the discernment, the good judgment, to see through this. The precepts are really a reflection of enlightened behavior, enlightened activity. They describe enlightened activity. And so someone who is truly realized will reflect that, the precepts, and will not want to harm others or oneself by breaking the precepts. The translator goes on a little bit. He warned his disciples about studying the koans of the old masters before seeing into their own nature. He did, however, say that it was necessary to understand these koans once the student did see into his own nature. Well, that's another problem today in the United States with more and more teachers conducting kind of koan circles where they invite students who've had no insight into their true nature to discuss the koans and offer their interpretations in a literary kind of fashion. It's just another virus that has infected Western Zen. But enough of that. Just to put a period on Basui's high regard for the precepts, he left, we're reading here, he left 33 rules of behavior for the monks at his monastery as part of his dying instructions. The first of these rules forbids the drinking of alcohol at the monastery. And he actually said, the drinking of alcohol of all broken precepts is the most upsetting to the serenity of the mind. Partly because once you've opened that door and you fall under the influence of alcohol or drugs, then you're more likely to break other precepts. Basui went so far as to have a shrine built at the monastery where he died, called, with a deity called the God of Retribution for drinking alcohol. So, I've heard that the Japanese lack a certain enzyme that would have allowed them to metabolize alcohol and that they're particularly vulnerable to alcohol. And Basui, to his credit, if that's true, he would have recognized that and called him out on that. And then just before we go on to his talks, a word about the title of this collection of talks. When Basui was asked to give a title to the text, he replied that it was not his intention to have this record printed. He didn't know, he said, what title to give words put together in such a coarse fashion, like mud and water mixed together. And from this conversation, the monk who put this together decided to call this Mud and Water. Now to the talks. A layman asked, what is the true meaning of the statement, outside the sutras, not through words? This is a classic description of the Zen school of Buddhism, is a teaching outside the sutras without reliance, no, outside words, beyond words without reliance on the sutras. The master, whenever I say here the master refers, of course, to Basui, the master called him at once, Koji. This was a term for lay students. The student said, yes. The master said, from which teachings did that yes come? The layman then lowered his head and bowed. The master then said, when you decide to come here, you do so by yourself. When you want to ask a question, you do it by yourself. You don't depend on another, nor do you use the teachings of the Buddha. This mind which directs the self is the essence of transmission outside the sutras and not through words. It is the pure Zen of the Tathagata. Clever worldly statements, the written word, reason and duty, discrimination and understanding cannot reach the Zen. One who looks penetratingly into his true self and does not get ensnared in words, nor stained by the teachings of the Buddhas and patriarchs, one who goes beyond the singular road which advances toward enlightenment and does not let cleverness become his downfall, will, for the first time, attain the way. As I'm reading this, I had the memory come up about how, according to a book I once read from, I didn't read the whole book, but there was a chapter in there that Roshi Kapila pointed out to me. The chapter was called The Language of Ah-ness, and it was written by a man who had spent many years in Japan and had come to understand the Japanese suspicion of articulate people. And he made the point that in Japan it's believed that if you're eloquent, good with words, clever, we could say in this context of this paragraph, if you're verbally clever, you're not to be trusted because you're speaking from the intellect. Whereas, if you are, you're more likely to be trusted if you are kind of at a loss for words. And the author of this chapter made the point that this extends to politics, that the Japanese have suspicions about a politician who's too eloquent. It's just a fascinating difference because eloquence is placed in such high esteem. It's not as common as, it's not as, you don't see it much in politicians anymore because I think they're mostly trying to equivocate and not alienate any particular group of people who might vote for them. And that's the point. There is this mind of grasping, of greed behind that kind of careful use of words. So there's a long history behind this, what Basui is saying here. Clever worldly statements, the written word, discrimination cannot reach the Zen. And to not let cleverness become one's downfall. In Japan, it's more a trust of what comes from the guts, from the hara. This is what can be relied on as more authentic, genuine, sincere. It's the language of honest. The title meaning, the tendency that such people have of just not even trying to describe something that is really sublime, for example, but just to utter, ah. Basui continues, this does not necessarily mean the one who studies the sutras and revels in the words of the Buddhas and patriarchs is a monk of the teaching sects, and one who lacks knowledge of the sutras is a monk of Zen, which is independent of the teaching and makes no use of words. The doctrine of non-dependence on the sutras is not a way that was first set up by the Buddhas and patriarchs. From the beginning, everyone is complete and perfect. Buddhas and ordinary people alike are originally the Tathagata. The leg and arm movement of a newborn baby is also the splendid work of its original nature. The bird flying, the rabbit running, the sun rising, the moon sinking, the wind blowing, the clouds moving, all things which shift and change are due to the spinning of the right Dharma wheel of their own original nature. They depend neither on the teachings of others nor on the power of words. It is from the spinning of my right Dharma wheel that I am now talking like this, and you are all listening likewise through the splendor of your Buddha nature. In other words, it's nothing we need to acquire. It's nothing that anyone has more than any other person. It is originally our own self-nature. He says the substance of this Buddha nature is like a great burning fire. How so? What does he mean? What substance is there in a fire? Well, none. That's his point. It is not a matter of substance. It is energy. It is this dynamic quality. Dynamic meaning in flux. This fluid quality. When you realize this, he says, gain and loss, right and wrong, will be destroyed. Life, death, and nirvana will be yesterday's dream. The countless worlds will be like foam on the sea. The teachings of the Buddhas and patriarchs will be like a snowflake over a burning red furnace. Then you will not be restrained by Dharma, nor will you rid yourself of Dharma. You will be like a log thrown into a fire, your whole body ablaze without being aware of the heat. He's talking about how we become when we are in harmony, in accord with our Dharma nature, our Buddha nature. There is a non-abiding, an unstuck quality when we are one with our true nature. And it's not such a far-fetched analogy. Fire. We are energy. We are heat. I once came down with a severe case of hepatitis. I was in bed for 2 months, and I could hardly get out of bed for weeks, and I realized that every one of us is like a dynamo, a furnace, a raging furnace of energy, and we don't know it. That is, we are that compared to how I felt reduced at that time. I felt like I was just a pilot light of the furnace in that state. But we take it for granted, or we don't even notice it, because it's just our normal state, this fire that we are. So he says, when you have penetrated the truth in this manner and do not stop where practice and enlightenment show their traces, you will be called a Zen practitioner. You do not stop where practice and enlightenment show their traces. In other words, never settling for anything short of the ultimate realization. This is the sign of a true Zen practitioner. Discarding insights, discarding can show itself. It's moving on and on, never satisfied, never complacent. And then Basui comes up with, tells a story here. There was the Zen master Ejo of Nangaku who excelled in learning the sutras. Before reaching enlightenment, he had an interview with the sixth patriarch. That's Hui Neng. The sixth patriarch asked, "What is it that comes in this manner?" Ejo could not answer at that time, and he carried his doubt with him for 8 years. He then came to a realization and went to see the sixth patriarch again. The sixth patriarch said, "What is it that comes in this manner?" Ejo replied, "One word of explanation already misses the mark." The sixth patriarch said, "This is still a disease of the mind." And so Ejo, again, he left and they spent another 8 years with this doubt mass, this question, until he came to a great awakening. Then he returned to the sixth patriarch, and again the patriarch asked, "What is it that comes in this manner?" And to that Ejo now replied, "It's not that there is no realization, but that it's not something that can be attained." The sixth patriarch immediately accepted this response. It's not that there is no realization, but that it's not something that can be attained. How can we attain what we have always been? This response, just by itself, on paper, wouldn't necessarily convince Wei Nung that this was someone of true realization. We can be sure that it was the way he said it, and everything about his manner, his energy field, was confirming what these words were saying, that he had grasped that fundamentally what is common to all of us is this enlightened nature. How can we attain what we already are? That's one primary understanding that has to mark true awakening, is seeing that everyone is equally endowed with this true nature. And then Basui continues, "If you were asked now, who is it that comes in this manner, how would you reply? And if you couldn't, how would you avoid a beating from the iron staff of the king of Hades?" Yamaraja, the mythological lord of the dead, who holds up, when you die, holds up a mirror reflecting your karma and where you're headed. He says, "If this were something which could be grasped through words and sutras, why couldn't the learned Ejo come up with a word to answer the sixth patriarch? If Ejo, not yet having attained enlightenment, were to answer in his ignorance, using his common sense and knowledge of the teachings, he might not have attained Satori. Aside from one who instantly penetrates Satori with a one-word response, it is rare to find one in this world who, like Edzo, has directly experienced Satori to its core. So, just to be clear, Edzo had been someone who was very deeply versed in the sutras and in the Buddhist doctrine, Zen teaching, and he was at a loss. He came up with an answer, that first response to the sixth patriarch, and it's not that you could fault that answer on a doctrinal basis, but that it was not informed with his own realization. No answer can be right, from a Zen perspective, no answer can be right if it is not come out, it has not come out of true understanding. There's a Zen saying about this. When a person of understanding expounds a false doctrine, it becomes true. When someone of no understanding expounds a true doctrine, it becomes false. It's not the measure of understanding is not something as abstract as words, as an answer. It has to be the experience. With the experience, you could say anything, and it becomes true. Without the experience, words pulled right out of the sutras become false. Basui continues, but there are those who, hearing a word from a teacher, have a great satori in which they lose their body and life. Some, alas, after 3 to 5 days, resolve their doubts, while others take as much as 3 to 5 or even 10 to 20 years before resolving their doubts. We tentatively give this period of doubt or questioning the name grappling with one's koan. Though the words may differ and some may realize Satori quickly while others take a long time, when realization comes, everyone wakes up to his or her original nature in its perfection. This realization is not based on words or phrases. So this one sentence is a little, I marked it a little, it's a little puzzling. Some, alas, after 3 to 5 days resolve their doubts, while others take as much as 3 to 5 or even 10 to 20 years before resolving their doubts. Why the alas? Some, alas, resolve their doubts after 3 to 5 days. I can only imagine that what he means is that they may have resolved their doubts, but they haven't come to realization. There's a way in which our aspiration does not go deep enough to really work for us in the best way, where we can come to Zen practice out of some kind of pain, emotional pain, even physical pain, I suppose, and practice can resolve that for us, short of awakening. I've seen this. It's hard to know how common it is because people just disappear. People disappear and they stop practicing. I don't interview everyone who comes to Zen practice. I don't know what brings them here as far as the particulars. But I know of cases where people come out of a broken heart and they they gain a measure of peace of mind it doesn't take years and years. And once that peace of mind on an emotional level, sometimes it's a romantic loss, when that is relieved, that pain, then they're off, because that's all they need for the time being. Maybe later they access a deeper need than just repairing a broken heart. While others take as much as 3 to 5 or even 10 to 20 years before resolving their doubts. Aitken Roshi, in his comments on the Mumonkan, mentions that he worked on Mu for 26 years. Now I'm skipping a whole slew of pages that don't seem to me to be suitable for Taisho. And we come to another questioner. Questioner, within the teachings it is said that it is easy for one to believe if the karmic relationship with the teacher is right, and it is easy to enter if the karmic connection to the way is right. Let's just run that by again. He's distinguishing between believing and entering the way. It's easy to believe if the karmic relationship with the teacher is right, and easy to enter if the karmic connection to the way is right. So obviously, of the two, it's more important to have a karmic connection to the way, to the Tao. And then the question says, so no matter how hard I practice, I could not be expected to reach awakening if my past karma were not right. Should I first try to practice a way that would set my karma right? You see, right away, there's this misunderstanding. Imagine that practicing Zen itself doesn't set your karma right. That's it. That's what it does. It purifies the mind and frees us little by little. Usually, it frees us from the bondage of our habit forces. That's setting our karma right. That's what practice does. But he seems to think that there is maybe he should do some kind of preliminary practice to be ready for Zen practice. And I suppose that's how it works sometimes. People do something else first that somehow ripens their karma with Zen. But let's hear from Basui. Basui, it is evident that some people have a karmic inclination for the way and others do not. Even if one were to preach the way of heretics, the way of evil spirits, or of the lesser vehicle, those who have a karmic affinity with a teacher, even in a previous birth, will believe him and call him a great teacher. On the other hand, even if one were a Buddha or patriarch, those who do not have a karmic affinity with him would neither believe what he says nor want to be near him. They would try to go far from where he dwells and slander him. During the time of the Buddha, there were some who slandered him and became disciples of heretics and demons. To follow either the right path or the path of heretics depends on your karmic inclination. So there's a lot of truth, of course, to what he's saying here. I used to just be flabbergasted that educated sophisticated, intelligent people could be attracted to teachers, not Zen teachers necessarily, but teachers who were obviously charlatans. I'll come right out and say the name of one, Rajneesh. Rajneesh was a character who was big in the 80s, I think. He came out with a lot of books. Worked the word Zen into some of these books, even in the titles of the books, even though he surely never had any Zen training. And there were a lot of unsavory things that happened at his ashram in Oregon, I think. And yet he drew hundreds and hundreds of people to the ashram and probably tens of thousands of people. He was a big celebrity teacher at that time. When I was Roshi Kaplow's lieutenant of some kind at the Zen Center, I took a call from one of Rajneesh's lieutenants, asking if Roshi Kaplow would endorse him for something or other. And I knew there was no question that Roshi would do that. But I took advantage of my audience with this assistant of Rajneesh to really challenge her on all of this stuff that Rajneesh was doing. She just maintained that this was his way of confounding ordinary people, his stockpiling of arms and his collection of 99 Rolls Royces and all things like that. This was his, what you might in Tibetan Buddhism say, crazy wisdom. This is always the trump card of people who want to defend outrageous, nefarious behavior by the teachers. Call it crazy wisdom. They just want to blow people's minds, do all these things, and really just upend them and rid them of all their notions of what's right and wrong. I really gave it to her, and she just maintained her calm. And afterwards, I reported back to Roshi, how did it go? Okay, blah, 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 blah. I kind of quoted myself, and he said, boy, that's impressive. And she was so non-reactive, that she wasn't defending him in any kind of ordinary way, except that this is just his way. And anyway, we just got off on a little tangent there. But yes, the point is that that people you would expect to see through this, who would see that the emperor has no clothes, and it's all other teachers now who have this is happening with. You would expect these people to see through that, and yet the one explanation. So what is the explanation? The one explanation is that they must have a karmic affinity with that teacher that overrides their discernment, their good sense and good judgment. Something keeps them there. And then this has happened for the longest time now, where this teacher or that teacher, a Zen teacher, a Tibetan teacher, falls prey to all kinds of scandalous behavior. And yet there are people who stay with that teacher. Again, a karmic affinity that overrides everything else. And then when that karmic affinity exhausts itself, when they're done, that's then, only then, it seems, do they leave. And then vice versa, where you have, he mentions the Buddha himself, where there are those who, without a karmic affinity, who would not only steer clear of the Buddha, this is in his own day, in the Buddhist time, but slander him and heap all kinds of disparaging stuff on him. And now Basui continues, when your karmic inclination for the Dharma has manifested itself, it is easy to enter the way. The teaching of heretics, the way of the lesser vehicle and of expedient means are all established as temporary truths. Hence, there will be those with karmic inclination toward these dharmas and those without such inclination. With the true Dharma, however, there is not a single person who hasn't the karmic inclination toward it. Now we run into a contradiction here. Let's go back up to the top of the page. Remember he said, it is evident that some people have a karmic inclination for the way and others do not. And here at the bottom of the page he says, with the true Dharma, however, there is not a single person who hasn't the karmic inclination toward it. So with this absolute direct contradiction, it could be a typo, actually, at the top, where he said that some people have a karmic inclination for the way and others do not. What the translator may have meant was that some people have a karmic inclination with Buddhism as a religion, if we can distinguish that from the way, or a teacher, a Buddhist teacher. Some have a karmic inclination with a teacher and others do not. Because we know what he says at the bottom of the page is true. With a true Dharma, there is not a single person who hasn't the karmic inclination toward it. Why? Because that is our nature. We can call it Buddha nature. We can call it Dharma nature. It is what we are. So, Basui continues, whether he is a beginner or an older practitioner, layman or monk, it goes without saying that all who believe wholeheartedly will attain Buddhahood. When talking about it, therefore, we call it the right Dharma, the original face of all Buddhas and ordinary people, the master of seeing, hearing, and perceiving, the 84,000 pores, the 380 joints, virtually the whole body is the Dharma body. What ordinary person does not have karmic inclination for the way? There is no ice or snow apart from water. The Buddhahood of ordinary people can be likened to snow and ice melting and becoming water. So we recite this in the Hakuin chant. Like water and ice, without water no ice, outside is no Buddhas. This is to the degree that one can believe this, these words of this great enlightened master, it should be enormously encouraging, heartening, that we are this nature. This is our self nature. How can we not have an affinity with it? How can we not find our way to the way? Our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.